According to Dissent magazine, Joshua Bennett is, quote, one of the most impressive voices in poetry today, quietly building a reputation as one of the brightest intellectual and political thinkers of a new generation. His new collection, Ode, perfectly melds his apt social and political commentary with the warmth and familiarity of the human experience. In Ode, Bennett, and that's O-W-E-D, by the way, speaks to the expansive range of registers within the world of Black aesthetics and experience, the joy, rage, love, terror, and awe that gives a world within a world all its shape and tenor. It is a great pleasure to welcome Joshua Bennett to the program today. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Very nice to have you on the program. Give us an idea of what it is like for you to put a collection together of your work, what goes into that process.
Sure. Fear and trembling, right? To use the old phrase, I wake up every day.
Yeah, that was like me this morning. Sure, yeah. Fear and trembling.
No, precisely. Yeah, no, I mean, I just wake up every day and stand frozen in front of a laptop, you know, for a while. And after I do that for a bit, I try to capture a sound, you know, maybe something I overheard someone in a restaurant say once, or a childhood memory, a line from a book that I love, and I try to turn it into music, you know. And I think after I've done that, you know, a couple of times, I'll maybe have 40 or 50 poems, and I try to get them down into a number and a sequence that feels good. So that's how the first book came about, and that's how the second one, Ode, recently emerged as well.
The first book was Sobbing School, right? The Sobbing School?
Yes, yeah. Sobbing School.
So when you're putting in that sequence, and because you mentioned music a moment ago, so that there is a melody there. There is a beat to it when you're looking at it.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I mean, I think I read back the entire thing last night in preparation for this interview and others. I mean, there are times where even the last word or phrase in a poem will rhyme with the next. but most of what I was trying to do was keep a kind of thematic melody, right? So the poems play off one another and lead into one another. I think that's really important.
Yeah.
You know, it could have just been a book of poems that I think are pretty good, but I wanted them to feel like they had a relationship to one another that was specific and true.
I wish all guests were like you and prepared for an interview. Well, but thank you. So let's talk about the book is beautiful. And tell us about, there is a photo on the front, and I'll allow you to explain it and why it was special to you and important to have it on the cover of the book.
Yeah, so this is a photo that my mother took of me and my dad 20 years ago now, back in 1992. I chose this photo for the book cover in part because I love the polo that I have on. It's rather stylish, you know, even back then.
Yes.
I was flexing on my pre-K colleagues. But there's a real intimacy here that I think is beautiful. It's my father holding me while I eat what looks like cornbread off his plate. And a lot of the book is about what's owed, you know, to him. And to people like him, to poor and working people throughout this country. You know, my father integrated his high school in Alabama, and before that was just one of 10 children, you know, grew up eating Red River clay and, you know, playing outside and just doing his best to dream, you know, to dream up a new world. And a lot of this book is about sort of the pitfalls of that dream, but also the triumph in it and the beauty of it.
How much does your childhood, does that upbringing, does even that time that is illustrated in that photograph shape you as not only as the person you are, but as the poet you've become?
Oh, it shaped me entirely. I mean, even I think so much of my commitment to education, even now as a professor, right, is rooted in the fact that my family loved books. They thought, you know, being steeped in literature was important. Having a sense of your place in history was important. And that first and foremost, I had to think of myself as a capable human being before anything else. You know, that's what was important in my household. And that's the kind of setting I try to create for my students. You know, I tell them, you know, books cannot just transport you places. They can expand you. You know, I think books make us bigger and they make all sorts of things possible for us politically and otherwise. And I think being raised by people that believe that, right? People that had literally lived through these major world-shifting moments in history was a major part of that foundation and me being able to build from it.
You talk about, and I'm interested in, again, back to the photo, but your work really explores a lot about that examination of your relationship with your father. Tell us a little bit about your father and how, and what you have found through that exploration of that relationship.
Yeah, so my wife and I, we have a little one on the way.
Congratulations.
In the next couple of weeks.
Oh,
thank you. Thank
man.
You so much.
You're birthing a book and a real baby. Good Lord.
Yeah, at the same time. Yeah.
This
book is his elder by a couple of weeks. Yeah. Just to talk about the photo, right? It gives the cover a completely different meaning.
Yeah.
I chose this cover over a year ago with no idea that I'd have a son specifically coming into the world, you know? And so exploring my relationship with my father through the poems, I think, has meant that I have to have more grace for him and more grace for myself. My father was the first person I told when my wife called me with the news, you know, that we were having a baby. And the advice he gave me was not heroic at all. He actually said, you know, you're going to mess this up at times. You know, you won't always get it right, but you always have to try again. And I think the fact that he led with that is really important, because that's also the best lesson I've ever gotten about writing or teaching or even just trying to live every day, right? You're going to fail. But what matters is what happens on the second try. And so, yeah, writing this book and exploring that relationship, it's given me more space to breathe and hopefully to, you know, be a better father to my kid, a better example.
It seems to me that the collection is bookended by poems that are somewhat bittersweet, blue in nature. And then in the center of the book, it kind of peaks as more hopeful. But you are examining the highs and lows of our possibilities for the future.
I think so. I mean, that's what I'm aiming at, right? Is to get at the brutal truth of the thing, right? Which is that it's not all terrible, and it's not all roses either. And I think I appreciate so much that, you know, you talk about the blue note, because that's always the note I'm going for, right? I mean, the first poem in the collection is Token Sings the Blues, and I think the blues is this incredible middle space between sort of terror and beauty. You know, to sing the blues is to have lived and reflected, and I mean, so Ellison says about the blues, right? It's sort of catastrophe, to paraphrase. It's catastrophe given lyrical expression, right? And that's always what I'm trying to write about, whether in poems or in essays or anything, or speeches, anything I put out into the world. You know, I want to strike the whole spectrum of human experience, because I think if you can sit in that space, if you can really rest with the blue note, I think you can make it through anything, to be honest. You know, that was a survival tactic my parents gave me, and I'm immensely grateful for it.
I didn't get to ask you this prior to us going on the air, but would you be able to read a poem for us?
Yeah, sure, of course. So this is a poem that I wrote way back when touring was still a thing, and when I would go to schools and high schools.
Days.
It feels like a lifetime ago. But when I perform, I'm a very sort of active performer on stage. And a student came up to me once and said, "You're so articulate with your hands," which I thought was really beautiful. So this is a poem by the same title. "You are so articulate with your hands," she says, "and it's the first time the word doesn't hurt." I respond by citing something age inappropriate from Aristotle, drawing mostly from his idea that hands are what make us human. Every gesture, the embodiment of our desire for invention or care. And I'm not sure about that last part, but it seemed like a polite response at the time. And I'm not accustomed to not needing to fight. If my hands speak with conviction, then blame my stupid mouth for its lack of weaponry or sweetness. I clap when I'm angry because it's the best way to get the heat out. Pop says that my words are bigger than my mouth. But these hands can block a punch, build a bookcase, feed a child. And when's the last time you saw a song do that?"
That's beautiful. Joshua Bennett reading from his new collection, Ode. I'm curious as to what it is like when there are these moments, like we're going through now, of, and we always have them, but of this ferocity of racial tension, and how that impacts you as, well, of course, as a person, but also as a as an artist and as a poet.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, part of the surreal nature of it, right, always, just as a Black person in America, but specifically as a writer, is that poems in the book, like Still Life with Toy Gun, for instance, were written years ago, right? And the fact that it still resonates this way is just part of the tragedy, right, right. Of this aspect of our American lives. Like, I was 11 years old when I first heard the name Amadou Diallo. I was a sophomore in college, I think, when Sean Bell was shot 50 times on his wedding night by NYPD. And so I think seeing these moments sort of return in waves over and over again, writing my first book after seeing, you know, Mike Brown shot in Lane in the Street, it's terrifying. But it's also a reminder that the work we have to do is not just the work of policy, right? It's the work of imagination. Right. It's the work of figuring out how we can get outside of these negative associations that we have with Blackness. Right. And that is the writer's work, I think, in some ways. Right. I think that's the writer's responsibility. It's the educator's responsibility. Right. Because those associations start when we're very young. And so this is also a moment, I think, when writers can sort of can take heart and remember that we have this kind of cosmic responsibility, I think, to help set the world right with what we put out into it. And that's a responsibility we should all take seriously.
And not that it's a competition, but that work can also be the truest.
Wow. I hadn't thought about it that way necessarily, but I think that's right. You know, I mean, what you said earlier about the highs and the lows comes in here, right? That when you know, I think, the great triumph and beauty that art produces, but you're also really willing to sit with this great tragedy, right? Even in the genre sense, right? That tragedy is about the loss of the beloved. I think that, yeah, the truest art comes from a place where you're looking death in the face, right? And are still willing to assert life, that there is some value to being here, and that we have to preserve that for one another, and especially the most vulnerable among us.
So another aspect to my last question to you is, does it impact your writing in the sense of when you read in the you hear or read or however that another Black man has been killed at the hands of a white police officer, shot in the back seven times? Do you have to have that seep in and think? Does writing ever go on hold for a moment, or is it a reaction often to what is happening immediately?
Yeah, to be honest, I think this is part of what's changed for me as I've gotten older as a writer. All the poems that I wrote this summer pretty much were about my son coming into the world with, you know, the pandemic in the background, the killings of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd and, you know, Jacob Blake in the background, and thinking about what kind of joy I would have to assert in the midst of that, right? So very rarely actually does, you know, a police officer does a gun make it into the poems. But with that as the backdrop, I think this time has actually really forced me to think about what I value in life and how I can put that on the page, because these are times where that's going to be absolutely necessary, right? We know in many ways the shape and tenor of the catastrophe. How are we going to survive it? Right. And how can poems assist in that process? And so for me, I haven't so much been trying to catalog the catastrophe so much as figure out how to build a boat, you know, that'll get us in it, through it, under it. And that's the work that I try to take most seriously every single day.
Well, I'm so excited for you, not only for the new collection, but especially for your son. And I congratulate you, and I hope you have a wonderful, wonderful time over the next couple of weeks and months. Joshua Bennett's new collection is Ode. A great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Joe. It's an honor and pleasure.
Thank you. Again, Joshua Bennett's new collection is Ode. It's published by Penguin. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.